Congratulations on a hardy crowd that came out in the rain. I'm Richard Cruz. I'm co-chair of the Council on Palliative Care with Cappy Flanders, and it is my great pleasure to welcome you officially on behalf of the Council. The Council has been in existence since 1994 and was started to promote the cause of palliative care, something which many of us feel quite passionately about. Its role is to perform service to the public in the form of workshops and informing both professionals and members of the lay public about the nature of palliative care, to assist people in understanding palliative care. Many of the workshops are attended by caregivers who are in the process of giving palliative care. I don't think we've ever counted the number of workshops we've given, but there are four or five a year, and it's been going on for a long time, so we really believe that that's had an impact. In addition, we look upon ourselves as being, a virtuous lobby group in our contemporary society, if there are virtuous lobby groups, in order to promote the cause of palliative care within our community and at the political milieu when it becomes necessary, which is actually quite frequently. This lecture is the 15th annual Goldberg Lecture. It was begun with an endowment from the Goldberg family, a family that suffered a very grievous loss of a young individual. It has served as probably the centerpiece of our community outreach activities. Through the years, we've had a series of wonderful, wonderful speakers, and I think that tradition is certainly going to be carried on this afternoon. We've been assisted by the Beatty Lecture Fund at McGill University for all 15 years, which is quite wonderful. That means that the speaker who comes to talk to you also must talk to students within the academic community at all levels, medical students, residents, nursing students, any student who's actually interested. And that also has had an impact. So we're very, very pleased. It is now my pleasure to introduce Bal Mount, who's actually going to introduce the speaker. Bal, within the palliative care community, I don't think anyone really needs to be told who Bal is. It is, however, useful to think back over the really distinguished history of palliative care within this community. First palliative care unit in the country, for many years the only palliative care unit that was actually centered in a teaching hospital, where that unit can have the most impact because you're in contact with people in all of the healthcare professions who will go out and further promote the cause of palliative care. And without question, that existed because of Bal. He has made enormous contributions to our community and to the world. The International Palliative Care Congress is the centerpiece of palliative care activities in the world for many people. So, no one better to introduce Dr. Carney than Bal, who is an old friend of Dr. Carney and I think knows him quite well. Bal?
Greetings. Thank you, Dick. 37 years ago, I was at St. Christopher's Hospice in London, England, and I met a young Irishman. He was a medical student from Cork, and I was a surgeon from the Royal Victoria Hospital in Montreal. In the intervening years, he became a physician, and he specialized in internal medicine, certified internist. Then he became the first person to certify in the new specialty of palliative medicine in the UK. Then as a palliative medicine physician, he worked as an attending staff member at St. Christopher's Hospice in London. He was part of the group exploring the possibility of a program in a really pioneering initiative at St. Thomas's Hospital in London. And then he went on to become the director of a major program in Dublin, Our Lady's Hospice. And that was an important, and still is, an important academic center in Ireland. In 2001 to 2003, we lured him here for 2 years, where he helped with some of our research and teaching programs here. Of his many contributions, his two really marvelous books written, published by Oxford University Press have stood the test of time. In her foreword to Mortally Wounded, Michael's first textbook, Dame Cicely Saunders, who wrote the foreword, said, "The way care is given can reach the most hidden places and give space for unexpected development." Well, over the last 4 decades, one of the people at the world community interested in end-of-life care and indeed whole person care has turned to for the cutting-edge developments and thoughts to do with how that care is given is Michael Carney. And our friendship has been a great blessing in my life. And he has been my teacher over all these years. Michael, welcome home. We're sure glad to have you here.
Well, good evening, everybody, and thank you so much, Bal. And I, too, am so grateful for our friendship and our colleagueship together through the years. Thank you so much. I'd like to also, at the start, just say my thanks to Cappy Flanders for the invitation to give this lecture this evening and say that I'm honored and delighted to do so. So my topic for this evening is the topic of caring for self while caring for others at the end of life. And I'd like to begin with considering the question, you know, why self-care? Why do we need to concern ourselves with this question? And by way of response at the outset, I'd like to suggest that this is in part because I agree with Michael Balint that we are the medicine. As he said in his book, The Doctor, His Patient, and His Illness, published first in 1957, we are the most powerful medicine we give our patients, talking to physicians, talking to clinicians. So if we are the medicine, how do we get to know this medicine? How do we use this medicine? How do we bring this medicine into our clinical practice? And alongside that quote of Balint at the outset, I'd like to put an image, and that's the image you see here of a Möbius strip. And I'm sure many of you know what a Möbius strip is, this very simple structure, which if you look at the left-hand side and you follow what is the inside of the structure on the left, and you follow it carefully as it moves upwards and continue to follow it, you will see that as it crosses from left to right, what is on the inside becomes the outside. And if you follow the outside as it moves from right to left, what is on the outside will become the inside. So is that, there is that continuity between the inner and the outer. And care of self is intimately connected with our care of others. I remember being at a conference in the 1970s in London, where the psychiatrist Sam Lifton turned to the audience of hospice clinicians and he said, you know, you go to the bedside of your patients to care for them, and that hospice care, palliative care, hospice care as it was called in those days, is all about quality of life. But what's the quality of your life? Because you go to the bedside as ambassadors of life. And so the quality of self is intimately connected with the quality of presence and with the quality of care that we bring to the bedside. Caring for self is intimately connected with caring for others. In fact, caring for self in ways we'll explore throughout this talk is caring for others. What I'd like to do this evening is weave a personal story into my comments about self-care. And I hope this is okay. And I'm going to do this in three parts. I'm going to talk a little about my experience of self-care at the beginning of my time working in hospice medicine. I'm going to talk about how it was about a year or so ago, and then I'm going to give you an update on how it is at the moment. So there'll be three different points of time. So as a medical student in Cork, in Ireland, in the 1970s, midway through my studies, I became somewhat disillusioned with medicine as I was experiencing it. The way medicine was taught in Cork in those days was that the initial years were years of scientific study without any clinical contact. And about midway through, one had one's first clinical contact. And when I had that initial clinical contact, there was some sense of profound disappointment, not in the patients, but in so many aspects of what I saw happening at the bedside. And I don't want to be overtly critical or unfair, but there was just some sense that this wasn't what I had been hoping for, and there was a deep disappointment, particularly about how patients who were suffering incurable and terminal illness, how they fitted in that system and the kind of care they were receiving. And I was thinking of leaving medicine, and I spoke to a mentor friend of mine at that time, and I told him I was thinking of leaving medicine, and he said, well, before you leave medicine, I suggest you visit this place in London called St. Christopher's Hospice. It's a place of healing. Those were his words. And I'd never heard of St. Christopher's Hospice. I'd never heard of hospice care. But something in the phrase, a place of healing, sort of caught my imagination. And so I made contact, and I went over to St. Christopher's, which you see here. And that was in 1975. And I attended a one-week training course, and then decided that this is what I wanted to do in medicine. There was validation of what my mentor had said. There was an experience in the presence of these persons I met at St. Christopher's of being in the presence of something very, very special, and I wanted to be part of this. So I came back and finished my studies and did a residency in internal medicine, and at that stage returned to St. Christopher's. And I worked there initially for 2 years. And during that period, I was lucky to work alongside Dr. Cicely Saunders, who you see here, who many of you know, is the pioneer of the modern hospice movement. And she was an extraordinary person to work with. And when I was there, I was lucky enough to work with others. Sitting alongside Dame Cicely here is Elizabeth Earnshaw Smith, who was the first time I was exposed to what social work was really about. And she was an extraordinary social worker. So I was very lucky to be there, and you may recognize the bearded figure in the background. I ran headlong into hospice medicine, as it was called in those days. I loved it. I felt this is where I wanted to be. This is what I wanted to do. And during that first 3 months at St. Christopher's, for the first time, I met individuals who had medical problems and human challenges and human suffering that I simply didn't know what to do with, that I just was unprepared to respond to. It just brought me very quickly to the limit of what I knew, not just what my skills were in the area of symptom control, but in the face of the most profound existential suffering, I found I was really ill-equipped and didn't know how to respond. And I think something else was happening in the presence of that suffering. Let me just tell you the story of Wendy, which somehow brings that into focus. Wendy, who you see here, was somebody who I met during my time at St. Christopher's. And she was a woman in her 60s, in her mid-60s, who had worked all her life as a school teacher. She hadn't smoked. She'd led a She saw it a good life and a healthy life, and she was looking forward to her retirement. And just before she retired, she was diagnosed with widely metastatic breast cancer. And if you look closely, you might notice on her arm a scar, and that was because she had widespread bone metastases, one of which had fractured. And she came to us from King's College Hospital, which was adjacent to St. Christopher's, having been admitted there, where she'd had surgery for her arm, she'd had radiation treatment. And by the time she came to us, her physical pain was fairly well palliated. But she was nonetheless in profound suffering. And her suffering continued. She lived alone. She wasn't well enough or strong enough to return home, so she needed to remain in St. Christopher's. And each day she struggled with the question why this was happening. Why had it turned out like this? This is not how she anticipated. This is not what she planned for. She was somebody with a deep religious faith, and she couldn't understand how this fitted in terms of God's plan for her, as she put it. And sitting with Wendy and her sense of anguish and her questions that didn't have answers, I remember sitting there and just the sense of impotence, the sense of not having words to say, not having a response in the face of her suffering. And so I met Wendy, and I met many others like Wendy. And while those early months at St. Christopher's were incredibly rich, and I felt I was so lucky to be there in the presence of such great teachers and was getting such extraordinary experience in teaching, I was also aware that I was facing and absorbing and immersed in just a lot of human suffering that I didn't have answers for, that I didn't understand, that I didn't know how to respond to. And eventually, a particular clinical event happened, a clinical encounter happened, which sort of acted as a final straw. And I went home the evening of that particular clinical event, which was along the lines of my meeting with Wendy, but just a little bit more poignant. And I went home just somehow feeling numb and feeling shocked. And what I'd like to do is just read you a short description of how things were the following morning. The following day, I came to work in a fog. This sensation lingered throughout the day, and I noticed that I could not easily concentrate. I was aware of a sense of dread in my chest, and I became more and more apprehensive. Then, as I sat listening to a colleague talking about a patient, a strong sense of déjà vu wafted from nowhere into my consciousness. It immediately captured my complete attention. I felt panicked. What was this? What did it mean? Was I having a nervous breakdown? In the midst of this whirlwind of images, feelings, and questions, I was suddenly aware that my colleague was still speaking, now with a look of concern on her face. I felt disorientated, confused, panicked. I couldn't make sense of what she was talking about. Then, the rumbling sense of dread in my chest swelled to a wave that seemed to crash right through me. I excused myself, I left the office, and I went outside and I bumped into Tom West, who was the then medical director of St. Christopher's, who was walking in the corridor. I asked if I could speak with him. He led me to his office. Tom listened attentively as I described how I was feeling. "You sound exhausted," he said. "You've been here 3 months now, and you've not had a break. You've thrown yourself into the work, and you're doing a good job, but I think that you may not have learned that you also need to take care of yourself. Two suggestions. One, that you take this Friday off, make it a long weekend, and go away somewhere nice with your family. Second, I can recommend somebody you could meet and talk with from time to time. I have been doing this myself for years, and I would not have survived in this work without it." My head was still reeling, but I felt relieved. I heard Tom say that he understood what I was talking about, and more importantly to me at that moment, that he did not think I was crazy to be feeling this way. Early the following week, I met a counselor whom I immediately liked. We agreed to meet on a weekly basis for the next 3 months. Little did I realize that I was experiencing what I now think was an acute case of what I later understood to be compassion fatigue. Little did I realize that I was on the threshold of what P.W. Martin calls an experiment in depth, and that I was unwittingly heeding Jung's advice to dive, not drown. So let me just say a little about compassion fatigue. Compassion fatigue, a phrase that you'll all have heard, is actually discussed in a very specific way in the literature. It's discussed as the cost of caring for others in pain and suffering. It's also known as secondary traumatic stress disorder, where an individual suffers trauma symptoms resulting from vicarious experience of another's suffering. So compassion fatigue, in other words, evolves specifically from the relationship between the clinician and the patient, that it's a form of vicarious or secondary traumatization. By being empathically open and connected with the patient within this conceptualization of compassion fatigue, we are vulnerable to being traumatized, secondarily traumatized by the other's suffering. And the symptoms of compassion fatigue are the symptoms that those of you that are familiar with post-traumatic stress disorder, increased arousal, re-experiencing avoidance, increased arousal, hypervigilance, re-experiencing walking by the room of a patient where one's had an encounter that's been particularly challenging and maybe traumatizing, and that evoking feelings of anxiety. And avoidance, where initially we might find ourselves avoiding that room, or avoiding the floor, going a different way through the hospital so we don't have to pass through the place where that event has happened. But the avoidance may chronically over time take the place of a gradual stepping back internally, even to the point of dissociation in relation to one's work. So within this conceptualization of compassion fatigue, empathy and the empathic engagement is seen as a potential, at least, liability. That empathic engagement is seen here as a key causal factor within this conceptualization and definition of compassion fatigue. And Charles Figley, who's written extensively about compassion fatigue from this point of view, writes, "The caregiver's empathy level with the traumatized individual plays a significant role in this transmission." So the term empathy level suggests that perhaps the deeper the empathic engagement, or the, at whatever level, the deeper level of engagement may make one even more vulnerable to the possibility of vicarious traumatization. And while I found there's something both interesting and I think accurate, you know, using the touchstone of my own experience with this description of compassion fatigue, it somehow doesn't fully fit with my clinical experience, and I know this is true for many of those of you sitting here, many who work in palliative care, end-of-life care, but indeed in other clinical situations, where the experience of being with somebody in suffering can also be an experience of richness and an experience of receiving something very valuable, which is hard to define, which is hard to describe, and yet one knows when you walk away from an encounter like that, maybe you have given something through your presence and through your being there, but you've certainly received something, and you're the richer for it rather than being depleted or wounded by it. So I was delighted when I came across this paper just a few years back by Richard Harrison and Marvin Westwood, in which they looked at the prevention of vicarious traumatization within a group of mental health therapists. And what Harrison and Westwood did is they, within their study, they talked to a group of trauma therapists who were identified by their colleagues as being therapists and individuals who were thriving in their work, who were seen as exemplary and thriving in their work by their peers, by their colleagues. They interviewed them, and then through a qualitative analysis, they identified a number of different protective practices. This description by one of the interviewees identifies one of these practices. "I actually can find sustenance and nourishment in the work itself by being as present and connected with the client as possible. I move in as opposed to moving away, and I feel that is a way I protect myself against secondary traumatization. The connection is the part that helps, and that is an antidote to the horror of what I might be hearing." So what this psychotherapist is identifying here is that the connection itself, rather than being the portal of traumatization, is actually in some way protective and protects the therapist from being traumatized or overwhelmed by the other's suffering. And not only that, but allows that connection to be one of replenishment. So in their discussion, the authors talk about the study having this novel finding that empathic engagement with traumatized clients appears to be protective, and how this challenges previous conceptualizations of vicarious traumatization. And they called this particular form of empathic engagement exquisite empathy. They define exquisite empathy as a form of empathic engagement that is highly present, sensitively attuned, well-boundaried, and heartfelt for another who is suffering. And this somehow brings me to the concept of the wounded healer and the idea of the wounded healer. Some of you may be familiar with the old Greek story of Chiron, who within Western medicine is identified as the wounded healer. And Chiron, as you can see here, was a centaur with the body and legs of a horse and the torso and head of a human. And the story goes that Chiron was a wise centaur, even though centaurs in that day had a reputation for being wild and unruly, and especially in the presence of alcohol, where they completely lost their heads. Chiron was recognized as a teacher. And prior to his wounding, it is said that the kings of early Greece send their children to Chiron for their education. But let me read you just a short description of Chiron's wounding. Chiron was a centaur, half human, half horse, and being a demigod, he did not die when one day he was wounded in the leg by a poisoned arrow, because he was a demigod. Rather, he lived on with a painful, unhealable wound. This was in his leg. Day after day, he limped around the slopes of Mount Pelion, searching for herbs that might ease his pain and cure his wound. And while he became knowledgeable in healing plants and herbs, he was unable to heal himself. He was, however, able to heal others. So those suffering all manner of ailments came to Chiron from far and wide, and each received a remedy that helped. Furthermore, Chiron's understanding and compassion touched something within them. As they walked away, they knew that a deeper healing was also taking place. So something happened in their encounter with this wounded healer that actually evoked some deeper healing within them. And it's that something that I wanted to reflect on. And that something wasn't Chiron's knowledge of herbs and his skillful use and how to use that herb. That something was something that seemed to be evoked by the wisdom that came from his living with his unhealable wound. That led him into some depth of compassion from which the other approaching him felt welcomed and met. And his particular way of welcoming the other within that place actually seemed to evoke some deeper healing in the patient, the one who was wounded. And so that brings me back to Wendy and thinking of Wendy and being in the presence of one whose suffering doesn't have any answers, of what to do when I'm in the presence of somebody, when I have nothing to say, and when I have nothing to do. What to do when there's nothing left to do, and what to say when there's nothing left to say. And what the myth of the wounded healer speaks to is that rather at that moment, rather than reacting, because that's a very uncomfortable, painful place for us to be as caregivers, on that edge, in that presence of suffering, where we know we have nothing to say, where we know we have nothing to do. So the temptation when we're under that kind of stress and in the presence of that kind of suffering is to react. And our normal reactions are either to go numb or to fight, which can take the form of treatment, and more treatment, or to flee, which means finding some way of leaving that situation, perhaps skillfully, perhaps not so skillfully. I have a colleague who I'd like you to meet. Or, crassly, there's nothing else I can do to help you. So that's the reactive mode of behavior in the presence of suffering. But there is another way, and that other way is the way of the wounded healer. And the way of the wounded healer means noticing at this moment what's happening. The way of the wounded healer implies, and I'm going to develop this point as I go along, that we as caregivers cultivate self-awareness, that we have cultivated self-knowledge, self-empathy, mindful awareness, that we are self-aware. So when we're in a situation like this, we're feeling stressed, and we can recognize we're feeling stressed. We've nothing to say, we've nothing to do, and we can recognize we've nothing to say and do. And rather than react impulsively in one of those more defensive ways, we can choose instead perhaps to acknowledge, you know, that there's not a lot I can say, there's not a lot I can do, but I'm going to stay with you. I'm going to do what I can to help, and I'm going to continue to come and see you. I'm going to continue in relationship with you. And within the dynamic of the wounded healer, something happens at that moment of acknowledgement by the caregiver that they're not omnipotent, that they're human, that they're fallible. That moment that where they say and they acknowledge, at least to themselves, there are limits to what I can do. And rather than fleeing into reactivity, actually staying with that and being able to stay with that in the presence of the other who is suffering. That what that does, gently and hopefully with compassion, is it hands the suffering back to the suffering individual. Not crassly, not crudely, but gently, and still within the embrace of caring. And as that happens, there's a certain encouragement to the person to stay with their suffering. They're now with their suffering. They may be alone with their suffering, but they're not isolated in their suffering. And somehow they have the courage to endure and the courage to stay with what's happening. And as that happens, an almost imperceptible shift can happen within the experience of the patient. Some kind of subtle shift so that the person says, the pain is still there, but I can live with it now. It's not everything is rosy. The problems haven't gone away, but something has shifted internally. In the words of Mark Nepo, the poet, in his poem Accepting This, and this is a fragment from his poem, I think what we're coming to here is a point of clinical humility, a point of accepting that ultimately we are small living beings awakened in the stream, not gods who carve out rivers. And holding this awareness, and in holding this awareness with self-empathy, while staying present to the other in their suffering, something may open, something may happen deep within the other, deep within their suffering. So this brings me to the story a year ago. And again, let me describe how things were. This is where I'm currently working in Santa Barbara, in California, in Santa Barbara Cottage Hospital. I work there as a palliative care physician, and I also work with home care hospice, an inpatient hospice in Santa Barbara. This time last year, I had been in end-of-life care for about 30 years. I was working full-time as a physician between a hospital and community-based palliative care service, and with a community and inpatient hospice program in Santa Barbara, as I say. And while I was truly grateful to be working with good people in good programs, I had become aware that I was no longer happy in my work. I noticed that I was not excited as I had been in those early days in hospice, going to work each morning. In fact, I was feeling emotionally and physically pretty run down much of the time. I no longer had that inner hum, that inner knowing that was there in the past and that came from sensing that I was in and doing the right work. Instead, I had the pervasive feeling, that I was not doing what I really wanted to do. And I was doing too much of what I didn't want to do anymore. I realized I was experiencing many of the symptoms of burnout. As I reflected on how this might have happened and talked about it with my friends and colleagues, I came to see that this was probably at least in part due to the 30 years of almost daily exposure to profound human suffering that came from working in end-of-life care. Burnout as a result of chronic vicarious traumatization, in other words. However, I concluded that this was neither the only nor possibly the main reason. When Harrison and Westwood described exquisite empathy in the way they did, and I've just described, they talked about something that I was familiar with in my clinical practice and experience and grateful for. And I could relate to the protective and renewing power of this way of being with others in their suffering. Indeed, when I did an inventory of those aspects of my work that were most meaningful and most replenishing for me, I identified just such occasions of being with another in a mutuality of suffering and healing, wounded healers together. I concluded that the other significant contributor to these feelings of burnout was a growing mismatch between who I was or had become and the role and tasks I was expected, needed to, and paid to perform in the work I did every day. Burnout as the result of the slow grinding down that comes from being a square peg in a round hole, or a round peg in a square hole. I knew that long-term sustainability in our work is dependent on there being at least a good enough fit between our calling and our responsibilities. And I realized that I needed to pay attention to this and that I would need to make some changes. I asked myself how much of this was about inner subjective change. If I didn't have much latitude in what I was doing at the time, were there changes in how I did what I was doing? And could that make a difference? And how much was it about needing to try to change external, objective circumstances so that what I was doing in my work, whether in my current or some other work setting, would be more aligned with who I was? So let me say a little bit about burnout. In contrast to compassion fatigue, which I've already discussed, as arising from the stresses generated in the interpersonal encounter, burnout results from the stresses that arise between the clinician and their work environment, or the caregiver and their work environment. An oncologist spoke about the stuff that burnt me out, he said, has nothing to do with the loss. It's fighting insurance companies. So burnout as a result of chronic mismatch, and that's a theory put forward by Maslach, who's one of the authors on burnout, one of the researchers who's done a lot of work and a lot of writing on burnout. And she's identified six key areas in work: workload, control, reward, community, fairness, and values. And her hypothesis is that the greater the mismatch between you as an individual and your work environment in one or more of these six domains, the greater the likelihood of burnout, because the more stressful it is and the more possibility of that leading over time to burnout. There are some specific stressors to those working in end-of-life care and palliative care, including constant exposure to death, inadequate time with dying patients, the need to carry on as usual in the wake of patient deaths, and with that, inadequate coping, feelings of depression, grief, and guilt in response to loss, communication difficulties with dying patients, relatives, and colleagues, and an inability to live up to one's own internalized standards. For example, to provide a good death every time for every patient. So just as there are some key clinical features of compassion fatigue, so there are some key dimensions of burnout, again identified by Maslach and her colleagues. And these are described as overwhelming physical and emotional exhaustion, feelings of cynicism and detachment from the job, sense of disconnect, and maybe over time a sense of cynicism, and a sense of never quite doing what you want to do, having a certain internalized expectation and goal and never quite achieving it. So a sense of ineffectiveness and lack of personal accomplishment. And this brings me to another story, and this is a story which was a favorite story of depth psychologist Carl Jung, and a story he was told by his friend Richard Wilhelm. And Wilhelm was a Presbyterian minister who spent many years in China. And when he returned to Germany and to the West, he brought, among other things, the I Ching, which many of you will be familiar with, the Book of Changes. But he also brought this particular story from his time there. He told the story of the rainmaker of Kiao Chau. And Jung said to his students that this is such an important story, he told them, you should never give a seminar without telling it. And so what I'd like to do is read you Jung's own account of the story of the rainmaker of Kiao Chau. There was a great drought where Wilhelm lived. For months, there had not been a drop of rain, and the situation had become catastrophic. The Catholics made processions, the Protestant made prayers, and the Chinese burnt joss sticks and shot off guns to frighten away the demons of the drought, all with no effect. Finally, the Chinese said, "We will fetch the rainmaker." And from another province, a dried-up old man appeared. The only thing he asked for was a quiet little house somewhere, and there he locked himself in for 3 days. On the fourth day, he'd been in there for 3 days, nothing happened. They came with his meals, they dropped the bowls of food at the door, they came back and collected the empty bowls. Didn't see the rainmaker, nothing happened. But on the morning of the fourth day, the clouds gathered, and there was a great snowstorm at a time of the year when no snow was expected, an unusual amount. And the town was so full of rumors about the wonderful rainmaker that Wilhelm went to ask the man how he did it. What happened in there? What happened in there that made this happen? In true European fashion, he said, they call you the rainmaker. Will you tell me how you made the snow? The rainmaker replied, I did not make the snow. I am not responsible for it. But what have you done these 3 days? Wilhelm asked. Oh, I can explain that. I come from another country where things are in order, in Tao. Here, things are out of order. They are not as they should be by the ordinance of heaven. Therefore, the whole country is not in Tao. And I also am not in the natural order of things when I am in a disordered country. So I had to wait in the little cottage. I had to wait until I was back in Tao. And then, naturally, it rained. So while I find that story of the rainmaker, which is really for me a story of burnout, because here was a country that was burnt out. Here was a situation that was burnt out. And they had tried everything for burnout, such as irrigation and as well as all the things that Jung mentioned in his telling of the story. And what eventually turned it around was the rainmaker, and not the rainmaker doing something, but the rainmaker somehow descending within himself. So, if you like, for the expected change was hoped for in the outer environment. But rather than concentrating on the outer environment, he turned inwards. And he turned inwards until once again he was in Tao, until once again he was in harmony with his deepest nature, which is somehow in harmony with the deepest rhythms of the natural world itself. And when there was that alignment, when he was back in Tao, the right things happened. It rained. And there wasn't any kind of causal connectedness between what he did and the rain coming. It was more an acausal, almost a synchronous happening, coming into Tao. Another idea which I found helpful in response to the challenge of burnout and the question of burnout is the idea of soul role alignment. And Parker Palmer, who many of you will be familiar with his writings, particularly coming as he does from an educational background, he talks in his book, Let Your Life Speak, of the nature of vocation as one's calling in life. And he says, vocation does not mean a goal that I pursue. It means a calling that I hear. Before I can tell my life what I want to do with it, I must listen to my life telling me who I am. I must listen for the truths and values at the heart of my own identity, not the standards by which I must live, but the standards by which I cannot help but live if I am living my own life. And within his description, vocation speaks of our deepest calling. And soul speaks of that depth, of the depth of that calling, and of that which wants to keep us rooted in the ground of our own being. And his idea is that disconnection, if there is a disconnection between soul and role, between our soul's calling and our life's work, that leads to a divided life and over time may lead to burnout. Whereas if our role is somehow in alignment with our soul's calling, that can lead to an experience of vitality and flourishing in our work. The next set of ideas, which I find really helpful in the face of burnout, come from this really important paper published by Balfour Mount and his colleagues Patricia Boston and Robin Cohen, published in 2007. And I really think this is one of the most important articles published in palliative care in the last decade. Healing connections, this idea of healing connections as facilitating a move from suffering to a sense of well-being. And I'm sure many of you, but let me just briefly summarize, many of you are familiar with this, but this was a qualitative or phenomenological study of 21 patients with life-threatening illness. And this group of 21 patients were experiencing either existential anguish or conversely the experience of integrity and wholeness. And they were interviewed in an attempt to identify inner life and existential contributors to either their subjective suffering or their well-being in advanced illness. And themes that were common across cases in those who were identified as suffering and anguish, and there were approximately 10 in each group, was a sense of disconnection in one of four areas: disconnection from self, disconnection from others, disconnection from the phenomenal world, or a sense of disconnection from ultimate meaning, however conceived by that individual. With that, a crisis of meaning, an existential vacuum, an inability to find solace and peace, a preoccupation with either future or past, a sense of being victim to disease, victim to one's disease, victim to one's life circumstances, and with that, a need to be in control. In contrast, in those cases who are experiencing integrity and wholeness, common themes were a sense of connectedness in one of those four areas: self, others, phenomenal world, ultimate meaning. A sense of meaning in the context of suffering. A capacity to find peace in the present moment. An experience of a different kind of relationship to one's disease process, not being victim to it, but somehow a sympathetic, non-adversarial connection. and an ability to choose one's attitude to adversity, an openness to the potential in the moment greater than the need for control. So in their discussion, Mount and his colleagues talk about the concept of healing connections. What seemed increasingly evident to the interviewers, however, was that meaning was not an end in itself, but a byproduct of a related experience, a sense of connectedness. It was not meaning per se that brought the person alive, but the underlying experience of being part of something greater and more enduring than the self. In each instance, movement toward a sense of integrity and wholeness was associated with an experience of healing connections. Conversely, suffering was associated with an experience of isolation and meaninglessness. Meaning unfolds in the context of relationship. So establishing healing connections, I think, is very, for me, very close to the idea of coming into Tao. And I think for each of us, we can think of perhaps our ways of doing this. And this is a highly individual process, and there'll be as many different ways of doing this as there are individuals. But I think those four areas that Mount and his colleagues identify in their paper can point us to some possibilities within the individual, meditation, reflective journaling, with others, spending quality time with loved ones, with the phenomenal world, whether it's through physical exercise, massage, time in nature, listening to music, with ultimate meaning, spiritual and religious practice. And exquisite empathy is also a form of healing connection, and this is recognized by Harrison and Westwood in their paper. Exquisite empathy, they write, affords clinicians the opportunity to ethically benefit from healing connections with their clients, and they refer to Bal's article, without sacrificing clients' needs to their own. In this sense, exquisite empathy may constitute a form of mutual, reciprocal healing connection in which clients and clinicians alike can benefit from the latter's caring, well-boundaried, ethical attunement to the client. And what makes the difference between everyday engagement that we all engage in and are familiar with, and what they describe as exquisite empathy? What turns everyday empathy into exquisite empathy? Their response to that is the presence of self-awareness. And they stress the importance of self-awareness, which they describe as moment-by-moment embodied awareness of self and surroundings, helps therapists develop the kind of interpersonal presence and clarity crucial to the practice of exquisite empathy. The practice of exquisite empathy is facilitated by self-awareness. And let me just reflect with you briefly on what is self-awareness and how can this possibly develop. And within our conceptualization of self-awareness, we've thought about it as having four aspects: mindful awareness, self-knowledge, self-empathy, and contemplative awareness. Mindful awareness describes focusing, the deliberate cultivation of focused attention by stabilizing the mind. Noticing, the ability to notice shifts in one's emotions, thoughts, and sensations while holding a friendly and curious attitude towards oneself. And expanding, a quality of awareness that allows one to simultaneously attend to another, the environment, and to one's own subjective experience. And these three different aspects of mindful awareness are all innate capacities of our awareness as human beings. But they are also capacities that can be cultivated, that can be enhanced, that can be heightened through particular practices. They can be cultivated as a set of cognitive skills which we can deliberately bring with us into our clinical encounters with our patients. Mindful awareness, as described here, contrasts with reactive awareness. And that's the default type of awareness that we're mostly embedded in. And this is not mindful awareness. What happens when we're in reactive awareness, which is a mode we go into, particularly in times of stress, when awareness constricts and with it our view of reality, and we become more reactive in our behavior. So if you think back to my description of the dynamics of the wounded healer, that moment of extreme stress, of being in the presence of overwhelming suffering of another, that type of stress, even if the clinician is there in an empathic way, but in the absence of mindful awareness, can all too easily lead to the sort of constriction of awareness and just the need to act for one's own survival, either by fight or flight. What makes it possible to stay there, I would suggest, is cultivating this capacity, enhancing this innate capacity, which we all have and we all practice, of mindful awareness. Self-knowledge is the old Apollonian dictum, know thyself. And this includes an understanding of our family, religious, cultural background, our emotional and psychological process, what we're bringing of our baggage, if you like, into the clinical encounter, and our having worked with and through these personal issues that could otherwise lead to prejudice, stereotyping, and countertransference reactions. It also includes more philosophical concerns, such as our understanding of the nature of the self. For example, do we see ourselves as discrete, solid, and separate entities, or more, as Mark Nepo described in that poem I quoted from, like particles awakened in the stream? Self-empathy involves our becoming aware of the sort of self-judgment and self-criticism that we carry towards ourselves, often unconsciously. Working with and through these feelings may allow us to cultivate an attitude of self-forgiveness and self-compassion. And finally, contemplative awareness speaks to an awareness of how we as individuals are situated in a bigger field of relationships and relatedness. And this includes an awareness of what brings us into a sense of connectedness and meaning, of practice and rituals that allow for direct experience of what might be called the numinous or the sacred. So for those of us who are interested in this idea of cultivating self-awareness as a capacity that can facilitate our engagement with others and our world, I would suggest there are two steps to how we move forward with it. One is to develop self-awareness as an ongoing practice. Find our own ways of cultivating mindful awareness, self-knowledge, self-empathy, contemplative awareness. And developing those capacities and those cognitive skills allows one in the moment to apply these self-awareness skills in exquisite empathy in the moment. Each of us will customize our own ways of doing this, and I just share a few ways that I have found and I continue to include as part of my life practice in trying to enhance those capacities. Mindfulness meditation, which comes from the Buddhist tradition and is now used also as a secular practice with great success for cultivating the particular skills of focusing, noticing, and expanding, which I referred to earlier. And there's actually an interesting and increasing body of data supporting that mindfulness meditation actually works in doing this. I also like to work with dreams, both as a way of, as a form of self-knowledge, but also as a practice of contemplative awareness. For me, dreams are a portal to that bigger sea of interconnectedness. I spend a lot of time in nature, both in my garden and in nature in other ways, and find again that that brings me into that contemplative awareness. And finally, journaling, reflective journaling, and I have found the practice of gratitude journaling, of reflectively at the end of a day, looking back on the day and identifying those aspects of the day that I'm particularly grateful for. So those are just some practices that I personally have found helpful. But I think the important point here is that for each of us who's interested in cultivating self-awareness to enhance our capacity to engage empathically in a mutually creative way with our clients and our patients is to customize our own plan around this. So while traditional models of self-care, and these are the dominant models in the workplace, are models that stress the importance of having clear professional boundaries and of, yes, having a good range of self-care activities, but having those outside the workplace so that, you know, we go to our yoga class or we go to our meditation group or we go to a concert and listen to some music. We do whatever we do that replenishes us, but we do that outside the workplace. But it begs the question, what about the workplace itself? And can the workplace itself potentially be a place of replenishment as well as a place of depletion? And if this concept of exquisite empathy speaks to something real in clinical practice, that would suggest that it is possible, that if we can engage empathically with others in our work, it is possible that as well as giving, we will actually be receiving. And that's led us to conceptualizing a self-awareness-based model of self-care. And very briefly, let me just show you what's here. That at the center of the diagram, you can see the clinician. And the clinician may engage with what's on either side with more or less self-awareness. And on the left-hand side is the suggested pathway of what happens when a clinician or a caregiver engages with less self-awareness with their work environment or with the patient's suffering. Then one is engaging in a more reactive mode. One is engaging with a less expanded perspective. It is more likely that the empathic engagement will be a liability in that setting than a source of potential renewal. And that can lead to compassion fatigue and burnout. On the other side is the suggested pathway of the clinician who interacts with their work environment and with the patient's suffering with more self-awareness. And here there can be that expanded perspective, that self-knowledge, that self-forgiveness, and that sense of being rootedness in a bigger picture that somehow situates this very personal encounter in a bigger context. And that really allows for the possibility of exquisite empathy and for healing connections. So it can go either way, this model suggests, and that is determined to a large extent by more or less self-awareness. So finally, almost finally, I'd like just to say a word on boundaries, and this is actually came from a talk I gave earlier today, just some ideas that came up in the discussion afterwards where there was a question about the different kind of boundaries, because in exquisite empathy, you may remember, we talked about a form of empathic engagement that is highly present, sensitively attuned, well-boundaried, and heartfelt. Well, what about these boundaries, and are there different kinds of boundaries? And the tradition models of self-care emphasize the importance of having good professional boundaries. And just a couple of thoughts in reflection, and one is that while good professional boundaries are essential, that's the first thing to say. We need to be aware of our limits as professionals and of boundaries in the area of clinical practice, ethical practice, and so on. We need to be mindful of that. We need to practice that, clearly. But there's also a danger in relying solely on good professional boundaries as one's form of protection within the workplace. And that is that good, clear professional boundaries can all too easily become rigid boundaries. And as they become rigid, they become fixed and they can become impermeable. And to be the patient on the other side of somebody with extremely good professional and clinical boundaries, which are fixed and impermeable, can be a very lonely and a very cold place to be, and a place where the patient can experience themselves in an objectified way. In contrast, the suggestion is that self-awareness may allow us to cultivate boundaries which are flexible and whose permeability can be modulated by self-awareness. And this actually, the wonders of Google Images, when I put in this afternoon semi-permeable membrane, this is one of the images that came up. And what I love about it is that it somehow kind of resonates with the iris in the pupil of the eye. And that idea of having boundaries that can respond to changing light in the same way as the pupil of the eye does. So they're not fixed, they're not impermeable. They can dilate and they can constrict, and that can be modulated, that we have some choice in that modulation, that unlike the pupil of the eye, which is a reactive process, we're talking here with a type of boundary. I see it almost as, I visualize it for myself as heart muscle, and and this somehow kind of speaks to that image of heart muscle, and that rather than having a shield around, a non-porous metallic shield around the heart, having this semi-permeable membrane, which can be modulated by self-awareness, we have some choice as to how open we are, or when we need to tighten the boundary, and perhaps take a step back. So we can move in, we can move back, we can be fully open, or there may be a time when we need to draw a line and step back and out of the situation for our sake and perhaps for our patient's sake also. So just, I share those thoughts with you. And coming towards the end, I would just like to share with you the situation now, 1 year on from the last bulletin I shared with you. So 1 year later, and now 31 years in end-of-life care, I continue to work full-time as a clinician in palliative care and hospice. And the external circumstances of my work have not changed, in part because it's not possible for me to change my external circumstances at this time. But over the past 12 months, I've continued to reflect individually and in dialogue with others on what it means to live with the daily reality of compassion fatigue and burnout as I continue to work with my colleagues in trying to alleviate suffering and promote healing in those we care for. And in the process, I've come to some insights that are currently sustaining me in my work. And while I fully realize that these are personal and individual, I would like to share them with you in the hope that they may have some resonance for you also. Self-care is not a luxury. Self-care is an ethical and clinical imperative. It affects both my sustainability as a clinician and also the quality of my work. Clinician self-awareness is the key, at least for me. It allows me to survive, maybe even to thrive, in even the most adverse of circumstances. Self-care is an ongoing process that needs to become as integral a life practice as eating and sleeping. From time to time, I have committed to making an inventory of those aspects of my work that are most meaningful and satisfying by asking myself, where and when am I most myself and most awake and most alive and most connected in my work? Where am I most myself, most awake, most alive, and most connected in my work? And I commit to trying to include as many of these aspects of my work as I can, and ideally have them written into my job description at the expense of those parts of my work that I find most depleting. And from time to time, I commit to making an inventory of those aspects of my life that are most meaningful and satisfying by asking myself, with whom, where, and doing what am I most awake, alive, connected myself? And I commit to making space and time for those relationships, activities, and practices and places that are most nourishing to me, that are most nourishing to me, and that bring the deepest sense of healing connectedness. And I commit that if, despite making what changes I can in and outside my work, I become increasingly burnt out, I will consider either a partial or complete job change to allow for a greater soul role alignment when circumstances allow. The wholeness is already there. Our task as healers of ourselves as well as others is to remember this, to radically remember this, and to do this both inside as well as outside of the workplace. This is not as easy as it sounds, but it is possible if we develop caregiver self-awareness. Self-awareness involves a commitment to deepening in self-knowledge, the practice of self-empathy and mindfulness, and experiencing connectedness and the sacred through the practice of contemplative awareness. Practicing self-awareness makes whole-person self-care possible. Self-awareness in the workplace allows us to engage in exquisite empathy with the possibility of protection from traumatization while simultaneously finding sources of nourishment and renewal in the work itself. But this alone is not enough. We also need times of retreat, times when we step back and completely away from our work and immerse ourselves in whatever is most deeply meaningful for us. Such times of retreat allow us to see our work from a different perspective, to sense the bigger picture, and to discern if soul and role are in alignment. This allows us to experience healing connectedness, to rest in the source, to be in Tao. And when we do, then naturally it rains. Thank you.
I have to make a comment before I present a gift and introduce Bernard. Several years ago, Dean Fuchs established a committee in the Faculty of Medicine to look at the subject of healing and to try and define it and describe its characteristics. There were several people who were key players in that. Dr. Mound, as you can imagine, Tom Hutchison, who's sitting here as well. That was during the time that Michael Carney spent his 2 years with us. As a direct result of that, the faculty, under with first Bal and then Tom Hutchison leading it, has developed a block within the curriculum that stretches throughout all 4 years of medical education on the role of the healer. We don't do it as eloquently or as completely as Michael has outlined it here, but what he has said so wonderfully is something which we are trying to inculcate into every McGill medical graduate, and he has played a very strong role in that. So we all have great, we are all very grateful, and every single one of you who is going to be treated by medical graduates of this faculty may well benefit from that. So, on behalf of the council, I'd like to present about 10 pounds of this to you.
Thank you so much.
And to introduce Bernard Lapointe to officially thank Michael after a question and answer period, which he will run. Michael is the current incumbent of the Eric Flanders Chair in Palliative Care Medicine, a role which he fills wonderfully. He is the Director of Palliative Care at Academic Palliative Care at McGill University, Palliative Care McGill, and the Director of Palliative Care at the Jewish General Hospital. So, Mike, it is over to you.
Dr. Courtney, Michael, thank you so much for a wonderful presentation this evening. I was struck tonight, like at noon today, by the depth and the true resonance of the concepts, the ideas, the metaphors, as well as the experience you share with us. And they are a true source of enrichment. Tonight I will go to bed replenished. everything you speak about, we know, is deeply rooted in experience and a remarkable know-how and know-how to be. I'm so pleased to recognize in you the long tradition created by Bal and others that are in the room of holistic approach and true respect of what it is to suffer. And I wanted, in thanking you, to acknowledge as well that in that true tradition of filiation, you were awarded this year by the Royal College of Physicians and Surgeons of Canada the visiting professorship that has been created in honor of Balfour Mount. So you are this year the Balfour Mount Visitor Professor of the Royal College. And this is an honor for all of us to share into that filiation. And just before we go into a period of questions, I wanted to tell you that not only it rains outside, but it snows somewhere in this universe because you brought us back a little closer to the Tao. So I would appreciate if there are questions for Dr. Kearney. There are two microphones. It's easier for us to hear your question as well as for people who will be tapping into this talk when it will be broadcasted on the web on the site of the council. Yes.
With all due respect, sir, I doubt if there are many demigods here this afternoon. And for us humans, it seems to me that although inner mindfulness is certainly significant, especially in the fields of health and sustenance, they unfortunately don't fully compensate for the lack of resources that often characterize our health and social systems. And so I wonder what mechanisms can be invoked to awaken this self-awareness and this empathy among those who control our purse strings. Do you have any suggestions that have been successful in that area, at least partly?
Thank you. And I'd love to hear if you've got some suggestions, because I certainly don't have any immediate answers to that. And it's true that I'm talking here about something that relates to the individual clinician. I think you also speak to the difficulty of doing that as an individual caregiver in the presence of a system where the external circumstances are so stressful that with even great a great degree of self-awareness. It's just very difficult to provide the sort of clinical care that one would really want to provide. And indeed, in a setting like that, being more self-aware and being more conscious can actually make the frustrations and the pain of that even more acute. I think the only other thing I can say in response to your question at this stage is that I do think that the whole question that I've been speaking to this evening, the whole question of self-care, as well as being an individual responsibility, that it's just too easy for the organization or the institution or the hospital to say, self-care is entirely the responsibility of the individual. And I think there is more and more evidence, not least that Maslach in her studies has shown that among U.S. physicians and nurses, there is a prevalence of burnout in 30% of clinicians, and in some specialties as high as 60%. And that burnout is not just about emotional and physical exhaustion and detachment and a lack of personal accomplishment. It's also about an increased rate of medical errors. It's also about less empathic clinicians. It's also about patients and families emerging from their time in hospital less satisfied. So I think there is a growing recognition of that. I don't know if that offers any hope, but I think part of the way forward in terms of self-care has to be the organization and the institution working in conjunction with the individual.
I wasn't being facetious, but although it may have sounded that, I really wondered whether the medical profession as a body surely carries a lot of weight in our societies. Has anything been done on an organizational level? I wasn't thinking of you just as a sort of a miracle worker, but has anything been done collectively in various places, whether in the Great Britain or the United States, that perhaps could be models for improvements?
All I can speak to in response to that from my perspective, and I would love if Bernard or, if Dr. Cruz or with some of the others here or Bal have some responses to that or indeed anybody in the group. But I know when I return from my week in Montreal, at the end of the following week, I will be attending an event in our hospital that is sponsored by management in that hospital that has been mandated by the medical bodies within the hospital that is fully supported, that is an initiative for physicians in self-care within the hospital setting. So fully mandated and supported. So that's just one little example of the fact that organizations can take the initiative in
Thank
this.
You.
Hello, my name is Susan Fleming. I met Dr. Mount in the 90s when I was working. I was working at the palliative care ward at McGill and trying to offer a little help to the dying patients, some of whom only had 2 weeks to live and didn't have a family member present. I was quite shocked when I was talking to one gentleman who whose family completely abandoned him at that stage, which I thought was... But yet I was quite impressed. I studied originally classical music, though I do have a background in medicine. And I come from a bunch of doctors. But what I wanted to say was I was singing, I thought you might like this, I was singing Danny Boy to a fellow who had been wheeled out in the bed by his wife. And, hitting the high Ds there. And there's a line in there that says, "When I am dead I well may be." And I think it was a husband who came in to me, "Excuse me, would you stop singing that song about death?" Yeah. So, but otherwise, I was impressed with the sense of humor. You know, these dying people had joke books, and I guess nobody has a sense of humor here. But anyway, I got out. I did suffer burnout because I was hit with lightning a few years ago. This is a true story. So I was advised to go to the Jewish General. I was sitting in a office there with an elderly gentleman who was snoozing by my side. I looked really battered and bruised. we were both waiting for the doctor, and he woke up from his snooze and said, "What's wrong with you?" I said, "I was hit with lightning. What's wrong with you?" You know. And he said, "Well, what are you going to do if you live?" And I said, "I was going to ask you the same thing." It turns out that was Dr. Michael Gold. He died at age 91. He was 88 at that point, you know. But this is the perennial question. What are we going to do if we live? How are we going to spend the rest of our lives? Now, I hazard a guess that nobody invented palliative care. And any palliative care, I would say the impetus for palliative care has come from the patients and from understanding doctors who have listened to the patients and realized that technology is not an asset, you know, at the very end. In fact, it's not, nothing is going to shield us from the end result. And just along that line, I would just like to share, I spent a lot of time in the Jewish General Hospital reading, I was reading a biography of Osler, and he was having dinner with a fellow from Oxford, from England, and he noticed the fellow was coming down with smallpox on a Thursday, took him to the Montreal General, where Osler was getting paid an extra $600 to run the smallpox ward, of which he bought 12 microscopes. And that was seen as sort of a novel idea because pathology was rather new science back in 1875. So, but what Osler did, and this is the point of my speech here, what Osler did was, the man was from England. He got the name of the man's father. He wrote a letter to the father outlining, you know, the illness, of course, you know. And he stayed with the fellow until he died, okay? He wrote the most lovely letter to the father outlining, he even gave him last rites. I was thinking, wow, this is a wonderful example of palliative care, you know? Yeah, so I just wanted to say that.
Thank you.
And on the other hand, Osler...
I'm sorry, ma'am.
Yeah, sure, sure.
Like,
okay.
anyway. This is a question, period.
Well,
Thank you so much. Time is running, and I had the privilege, really, to listen to again to Michael. Thank you to all the members of the council and its co-chairs, De Cruz and Cappy Flanders, for organizing this for us this evening. I see there's one more person at the microphone. I will allow one question.
Thank you.
Not a speech.
Thank you, Dr. Kearney.
Thank you.
I will try to be very brief.
Sure.
I'm not a clinician. At this stage of my life, I'm... seem to be a full-time caregiver, and I wanted to say that the points that you make for the clinicians seem to me to be directly applicable to us. I wonder if you have anything to add to your from your presentation to people who are not clinicians, those of us who are engaged in full-time caregiving for loved ones.
Thank you. Thank you for your comment and your question. I really tried to use clinician and caregiver interchangeably in my talk because I was really thinking and feel that really the ideas I did share this evening are not just for professional caregivers or professional clinicians, and particularly this idea of exquisite empathy. You know, and you know, I think all the ideas—the idea of compassion fatigue, and just the ability to be in the presence of suffering over time in a way that isn't depleting and possibly even traumatizing—recognizing the difference between that and burnout, and recognizing, I think, above all, the concept of exquisite empathy and how that allows us to stay in for the long haul. In my talk at noon today. I really worked with one image, and that was the image of learning to breathe underwater. Mm-hmm. And the classical model of self-care really suggests that if we hold our breath underwater, if we really, you know, have good professional boundaries in stressful clinical situations, and then come up for air, as in our break time or our time out or our times outside work. And of course, that model is valuable and it's good for caregivers as well as professional clinicians. But the image of learning to speak underwater learning to breathe underwater speaks to the idea that it is actually possible to find oxygen in the situation itself. And I think that's why I come back to the cultivating the capacity of self-awareness. And it's, you know, I know it gets close to being a little too evangelical around an idea that one finds particularly helpful. But I think that particular skill, cultivating that particular skill, does make it possible over time for us to breathe underwater and to be there for the long haul.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, sorry. Again, thank you, Michael. Thank you, everyone. Please join us in a small refreshment, little reflection. I'm sure we have a lot to talk together about. And just in reference to the first question, this week we are celebrating National Palliative Care Week across Canada. There are dozens of national organizations joined together into a national coalition for quality end-of-life care. I invite you to directly support those organizations. Have you written your... I'm not facetious. Have you written your MP? Have you written your MNE to request quality end-of-life care in Montreal, in Quebec, and across the country? We cannot do this if you're, the doctors or the nurses cannot do this alone. They need you to write and start right now. Thank you very much.